and welcome to the Metro West Daily News Podcast. Today is Friday, December 9th, and Bill, Shaner, and I are sitting here with State Senator Jamie Eldridge, who has a couple of things that we are going to talk to you with him today. So, first of all, Senator Eldridge, thank you for coming by.
Thank you, Megan. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
So, you were in Framingham earlier today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you were doing today?
Yes, I was in Framingham this morning for the monthly Metro West Advocacy Coalition, which is a coalition of the human services agencies in Metro West, organizations like Advocates and SMOC. And we were discussing, first of all, what the possible impact of President-elect Donald Trump, the Republican Congress, could be on everything from healthcare to human services, and how the state legislature might respond to that. We also talked about, even more timely, the budget cuts that Governor Baker just issued on Tuesday, and how that was already affecting various human service agencies, and also about sort of telling the stories about the impact of those cuts.
So what were some of the big cuts that people seem to be most concerned about?
Yeah, so there were a number of cuts, and even though, you know, at first glance, some people might say, well, those are minor cuts, but they really have an impact on the services throughout the state, including Metro West. So one of them is Governor Baker cut homeless assistance. So, you know, addressing providing housing and other support for homeless individuals or families. So there was money cut from that. There were some cuts in terms of access to services for mass health recipients. So low-income families that have mass health, you know, it could be harder for them to gain access to some services. And then there were also cuts to programs like the Down Syndrome Clinic, addressing the opioid crisis, more money for treatment. And finally, cuts to just sort of general agencies, administrative cuts that could reduce the staff that provide support for human services.
So, yeah, we had a story about the cuts this morning, and it looks like it could be pretty rough for a lot of local agencies that try to fill in those gaps of what other public services there are and what people have for themselves.
Absolutely, yeah, and I know one of the earmarks that I had fought for Sudbury was the Metro West Free Medical Program, which, you know, recognizing that everybody has health insurance, so it's a great clinic for those that don't have health insurance to get support from retired doctors and nurses through the congregation in Sudbury. So the money that I had secured was going to be for more medical equipment, so that was eliminated by Governor Baker. And I think now the legislature is beginning to have discussions about, do we try to replace that funding in the new year with a supplementary budget?
There are also some pretty significant cuts to environmental agencies and programs. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those.
Yeah, one of my biggest disappointments with Governor Baker is that when he campaigned, he talked a lot about being an environmental governor and actually increasing the bottom line for environmental agencies. Unfortunately, through retirement packages and just general cuts to funding, our environmental budget is at its lowest in about 10 years. So what Governor Baker did with the 9C cuts this week is actually 10% of the $98 million cut was cut from the environmental budget. So, for example, the DEP administrative line item, so cutting staff that are enforcing our clean air or clean water laws.
Right.
Storm management, which is a real big issue in Metro West with all the new development. You have a lot of stormwater that is developed. There's a federal mandate for that, but he cut funding for stormwater management for cities and towns. And then DCR, so, you know, our state park system. I'm very proud of the parks in Metro West, and he cut some of the funding for that. So there's a real concern that, you know, this will just be the first sign to the environmental budget being cut further into the new year. And there's already talk about, you know, pushing back and making sure that Governor Baker, when he proposes his budget for the FY18 fiscal year, that it doesn't see deeper cuts in environmental protection.
So, switching gears a little bit. So, last week, it was like right after Thanksgiving, you were part of a protest to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, mm-hmm. and you were arrested.
Yes, I was.
So, my first question for you was, have you ever been arrested before?
I have never been arrested before, no, and I wasn't really planning on it, but I was asked by the Raise Up Mass Coalition, and, you know, in solidarity, I decided to do it with McDonald's workers and in labor activists.
Right, and why do you think it was important for you to be there at that protest?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's really been a very positive response from constituents. I honestly wasn't sure what the response would be,
right.
But I think you have a cynicism out there that people really don't think that politicians are really fighting for policies to help people, especially people who are less well-off. And so just sort of people seeing the picture of my getting arrested and reading the story said that, you know, this is someone that, you know, actually followed through on something and something that he believes in. So for me, I've been a long-time supporter of raising the minimum wage. It's important to think that, you know, even the current minimum wage, which was one of the highest in the country, really...
it's $11 an hour,
worker,
right?
Yeah, it's $11 an hour as of January.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Okay.
And that would amount to a salary between, you know, $23,000 and $25,000 a year for a full-time worker. So, you know, not enough for most parts of Massachusetts, especially Metro West. So, you know, now we have the opportunity, and there'll be legislation filed to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour next session. So the protest and the rally and the arrest was an opportunity for elected officials, for labor activists, for minimum wage workers, many of them who work at McDonald's or other fast food restaurants, to, you know, take a stand and raise the consciousness over both the Fight for 15 movement, but also the fact that so many people who are working very hard are still living in poverty.
So what's happening with what's happening with the charges?
Yeah, so fortunately, due to great legal representation and I think an appreciation from, you know, Cambridge Police and our district attorney that, you know, this was a symbolic arrest and a stand for a good cause, that the charges were dismissed by the end of the day last Tuesday.
Oh, that's good. That's
with a court fine. So,
right.
So although I do point out, as someone who's a big advocate on criminal justice reform, is just the fact that I was arrested, you know, creates a record.
Right.
And you know, that's a reminder to us at how easy it is to get caught up in the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
And how that would negatively affect your employment or your life going forward.
Well, you had a story the other day. This guy was arrested for dancing in the street, right?
Yeah.
So
dancing in the middle of the street.
Same
charge, actually. Disorderly conduct, right?
Yeah. Disturbing the peace and blocking
the peace.
Public way.
Okay, so not the same charge, but on the same level.
Right,
yeah.
In Massachusetts, or?
Yeah,
it was in
Massachusetts.
It was in Framingham.
Yeah.
It was actually at the corner of Concord and Union in Framingham, so right in the middle of that very busy intersection.
But I was saying to another editor here, I know that...
Different sort of...
Right. I know that in other places across the country that often is, like in Ferguson, Missouri, people mm-hmm. were arrested all the time for something like walking in the street, which
absolutely.
If you can't pay the fee, and then that racks up and creates a really legal, huge problem for something that
absolutely.
Seems pretty minor. Yeah.
And in Ferguson, I think it was a revenue source for the city that was disproportionately on, you know, black and brown residents.
Right,
so.
Right. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you're going to ask something?
Yeah, sure. I have a kind of a more general question, but it seems that, you know, social justice and activism plays a larger role in your leadership style than the average senator. I mean, it's not every day that someone... in a position such as yours gets mm-hmm. Arrested at a protest. And I'm wondering if you can speak on that and how you see those kind of things playing into your larger role as a legislator.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say I laughed at the line in one of the news stories that said, you know, Senator Eldridge, co-chair of the Joint Committee on Financial Services, was arrested today for a minimum wage increase. So good to make the point that even if you have a position like that, you should be standing up for social justice.
Right.
But yeah, I would say, first of all, one of the things I talk a lot about in my sort of coming to the legislature is that I was an activist, I was an organizer, so, you know, I managed political campaigns, I was a legal aid attorney, I worked on a lot of coalitions on social and economic justice issues. So I really see my role as a legislator is it's not simply sort of the more, you know, typical filing legislation and, you know, testifying and working at the State House, but working outside the building on coalition efforts. So I've done that a lot on immigration reform, on criminal justice reform, as well as energy and climate change issues. And I really think it's important to remember, especially in sort of our post-November 8th election environment, that
right.
It's really important for everyone to take political acts. You know, one of the things I said to the League of Women Voters recently at a meeting in Acton is that, you know, doing sort of charity work or sort of quieter advocacy work, that's important, but it's really about, you know, now I think about taking stronger political action. That doesn't have to mean it's an arrest, but it's attending a rally, it's, you know, meeting with your legislators, mm-hmm. it's attending, you know, a forum and speaking out and not just staying silent. So I really see this as something I've always done, but I wanted to step up a little bit and get arrested because there's a lot of fear about what will happen, you know, next year under a Republican Congress and President Trump.
So speaking of the election, So as a local journalist, I have covered and followed many local races, and I have to say that your race with Ted Busick was very different. And I don't want to editorialize it, but Ted Busick, he is a Republican from Lincoln. Littleton.
Mm-hmm.
Littleton, Lincoln. He's from Littleton, and he pretty much openly said offensive things on Twitter. He kind of went at you a lot. He went after supporters. He espoused a lot of views very visibly on Twitter that most people would find reprehensible. And I'm just curious, I mean, I know you beat him very handily. Obviously, the voters of your district like what you're doing and want you to continue. But I'm just wondering how that was for you. I mean, we get some blowback as journalists a lot from people accusing us of bias and that kind of thing. But, I mean, you're allowed to be biased, you know. But my question is just, it was just very strange watching it. And I'm wondering how it was living it.
Yeah, it was definitely a very strange race. And I think that as someone going into this election cycle, not knowing the term alt-right, and then having someone who, you know, self-described, you know, alt-right, learning what that is, and actually, you know, now, quite honestly, I use the term, you know, white nationalist, because, you know, I openly had exchanges with my opponent where I said, you know, do you believe that if there is an owner of a restaurant who is white, that he or she has the right to deny service to someone based on their race or ethnicity? And him responding, yes, I do, is taking that to be very clear. And I, you know, honestly, I think journalists need to do this as well, is if that's someone's view, they're reporting it, you know, as such. And so,
right.
you know, think the fact that I had an opponent that, you know, openly supported discrimination, used, you know, homophobic slurs, and was very comfortable about that despite getting a lot of blowback, as you said, and a lot of opposition, you know, in some ways across the country from people through social media. So, you know, I think it's important to recognize that part of what we're seeing right now with, you know, hate attacks and part of, I think, how Donald Trump was elected, even if it was a small group, was sort of this white nationalist movement, and we really need to call it out. I know that many people of color, many immigrants in my district are very, very scared about what they're experiencing. They're hearing about, you know, people saying to them, you know, go back to your country, why are you here in America? So I think we need to stand up for it. I was proud of the campaign that I ran and glad that I won, but I do think it's important to realize that, you know, people like Ted Busick are still out there, they still have the same beliefs, and we really need to push back on that here in Massachusetts.
Right, so in Massachusetts, it's not typically, I mean, perhaps stereotypically, the place where you think something like white nationalism or neo-Nazism. You know, the AP Style Guide actually came out with a post recently that said the alt-right is not really a preferable term. Mm-hmm. Like, a more preferable term would be, you know, white nationalists.
Call them what they are.
Neo-Nazism.
The AP is really big on accuracy. Like, what they are is...
Yeah,
and... white nationalists, white supremacists,
right?
Members of the KKK or whatever they might be.
It's so critical for journalists to to do obviously follow that. Yeah,
and
politicians. Yeah,
it's kind of it's strange to my eyes, but I wonder if his candidacy represents a growing of that sort of ideology in the area. Is that something that you've seen or think about? Or
well, I've certainly I think that what the conservative movement has always done is often called, quote-unquote, working the refs, is always, attacking journalists that are doing, real honest analysis and saying, well, you shouldn't be calling us something. You should just say, well, he said, she said. Well, I personally don't think that's, good journalism. And I think that elected officials, need to do that as well. And so that's why, certainly that's the terminology that I, plan to use going forward about, saying someone's a white nationalist if they believe in discrimination against, many different groups in America. And I do think it's part of a growing movement. Actually just at the Metro West Advocacy Coalition, one person shared the fact that someone they know works at a bank, a person of color, said that a customer came to his window and then, said, oh, well, I don't have to go to you to get services. You shouldn't be serving me. So just the fact that sort of thing is happening is extremely disturbing, and we have to call it out and oppose it.
Definitely. And so another thing that you had tweeted this morning that you wanted to talk about was the Trust Act. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's, front and center of an opportunity for Massachusetts to stand up for, immigrants, communities of color, that we can take action to whatever the federal government does. So there's a lot of concern right now about what President-elect Trump might do with deportations.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, unfortunately, our current president, Barack Obama, I commend his efforts to pass immigration reform, but he's also overseen the highest number of deportations of any other president in recent history.
Right.
So that is in part under a program called Secure Communities that is supposed to just target undocumented immigrants who are violent criminals. Unfortunately, most statistics show that about 50% of the immigrants, and this is absolutely happening in communities like Framingham with the large immigrant population, are being deported who haven't broken any state laws. They are here without legal papers, but they haven't broken any state laws. They're, to a person, working hard, trying to provide a better life for their families. The concern is that those deportations will increase under President-elect Trump.
Right.
So the bill that I have filed, the Massachusetts Trust Act, would limit the ability for state and local police to detain undocumented immigrants to hand them over to Homeland Security or ICE immigration officials. And it would merely say that, look, if someone is, pulled over or arrested for a serious crime, obviously they should be detained. But if they're being pulled over for speeding and they haven't committed, any serious crimes, they should be released just like any other American. And I think this is a real critical point to see where, my colleagues, where Governor Baker stands with the discussion over whether local and state resources, i.e. our law enforcement, should be engaged in enforcing, federal law, immigration law. I don't think that they should. It's, right. Not only a waste of money, but it's creating an atmosphere of fear where immigrants in a community are going to be afraid to go to their local police if they see a real crime going on because they're afraid of being deported. Right. So that makes all of us less safe. And
we definitely have local police chiefs who say that exact thing, that mm-hmm. it takes up resources, it's not their law, really, it's a federal law, and that exactly, like, if there is a crime being committed and there are witnesses, they should be able to come forward without any fear of reprisal.
Absolutely, and the Framingham police has been very, very supportive, I think, of a police force that's very committed to recognizing the diversity in Framingham, But, you know, not every community is like that, and also that you have the question of state police.
Right.
So that's why we need this bill.
I was going to say that in June, actually, Governor Baker reversed a policy mm-hmm. directive of Deval Patrick that prevented state police from assisting ICE agents. And mm-hmm. That is kind of directly at odds with your proposed legislation, which kind of mirrors, correct me if I'm wrong here, but mirrors sanctuary city legislation in Somerville, Cambridge. I think those might be the only two sanctuary mm-hmm. Cities in the state. But and I was wondering if that is kind of, do you see that playing out at all as an issue in getting this passed?
Well, that's definitely a area of disagreement, and I have called on Governor Baker to rescind his rescinding of Patrick's order. Mm-hmm. So, and there's an effort by Progressive Massachusetts to do that, which I work with. So I'm hopeful that he will rescind that. I'm not sure what will happen, but yeah, that is contradictory to the bill that I'm filing. And
right.
You know, if the bill that I filed passed, it would overrule part of that order.
Right. So Trump has really thrown around the cutting of federal funding to sanctuary and sanctuary-like mm-hmm. Policies. Campuses, cities, states that adopt such policies as to not cooperate with mm-hmm. with ICE. And I'm wondering if that's in filing this legislation, if that's a threat you take seriously.
Well, I do think, you know, there's times where elected officials really need to draw the line, and I know that Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone, when he was asked, you know, well, if the city risks losing federal funding, are you still going to remain a sanctuary city? And he said, absolutely, there are some things that are, you know, more important than federal funding. So I think that we need to take that stand. I also think it would be difficult for the federal government to actually pass legislation to deny that funding, because it's a very complicated issue.
Right.
But I do think it's important to take a stand, and you know, that's certainly where I stand.
Do you get any blowback from constituents about immigration issues or these kind of progressive causes that you fight for?
I definitely do. You know, there are, you know, a decent number of more conservative constituents of mine that do have strong views on immigration. I would say generally I feel that the district I represent is very supportive of diversity and recognizes that it's a strength of the district in Massachusetts. But there, you know, there are people that call that disagree with me. I think, you know, my approach, and I guess so far it's been successful, is that I try to get back to people. I'm up front with them and say, hey, you know, you might not always agree with where I stand, but you know where I stand. And there are at least some voters, I think, that, you know, appreciate that and say, well, at least he gets back to me, at least he, you know, stands for something. And, you know, I would say in some ways my recent arrest is a perfect example of that.
All right. I think this might be our last question, but I want to talk about the fact that you started a podcast and what you think about the medium and how it might benefit you as a senator.
Yeah, it's been great, and it was something that I've been thinking about for a while, and then I have a new communications director who is just very creative in thinking about these things. And so we did our first podcast looking at anti-poverty issues mm-hmm. This week, and it just went live yesterday. I interviewed two Muslim American leaders in Massachusetts to talk about Islamophobia mm-hmm. and attacks on Muslims, as well as things like, you know, where does the Democratic Party stand in respect to its values. So far, it's been a really good way to reach people that I think are especially focused on activism and issues, and, you know, create a conversation that I hope, you know, helps my legislative agenda and just issues in general.
Are you in the iTunes store?
Yes, I just got added to the iTunes store.
Awesome. Oh, so I'll put a link in the show notes, but what's it called for people who want to search for it?
Yes, it's called The Eldridge Files.
That's cool.
Couldn't think of anything else. So.
That's pretty good.
I like it. It's more creative than the Metro West Daily News podcast. we just keep it simple.
Well, this has been really great. Thank you so much for stopping by. It was really nice to talk to you.
Megan and Bill, thanks so much for having me, and hope to talk to you in the future.
Definitely. now it's time for Around the Keurig, where we talk about the things that we've been listening to, reading, watching, etc., the past week or so. So, Bill, why don't you kick off this week's?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have been talking about this, and it was released maybe a week and a half ago, and I just got around to reading it yesterday. But it's a really great piece of narrative, long-form journalism from the Boston Globe. It's called The Power of Will by Billy Baker, and it follows the story of Will Lacey, a little kid from Braintree, I think, that was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer called neuroblastoma, and it follows him, his parents, and a doctor who may or may not have a cure in a narrative way through many years of this child's life, and it probably takes about an hour and a half to read, but it is so worth it. It's one of the most kind of life-affirming pieces of journalism I've read in a long time.
You linked to it on Twitter yesterday, and so I read it too. And I agree, it is wonderful. Billy Baker is really very, very, very good reporter. There are these hand-drawn illustrations that accompanied each section, which were great.
Yeah, they're really nice.
And it really, you know, childhood cancer is such a terrible, terrible thing to even consider. And, you know, I've had to take my kids to children's hospital for, like, really comparatively minor things. Mm-hmm. And you see the kids there who are really quite sick, and it's always a humbling experience. And reading this was just, this kid's parents are, especially his father, are so, they were so dedicated to finding him treatment that would work. And so I agree with Bill. It's definitely an awesome, a good piece to sit down and read and then finish it and then kind of step away and walk away for a little bit and think about.
Right. It's a shame it was released so late in the year, because I feel like it would just be on every year-end best journalism, best journalism of the year lists. I mean, it probably still will be. I follow a site called Longform that posts a lot of really good magazine journalism, and they had it as like their best article of the week.
Yeah.
It really is just
incredible. You are, I was a little trepidatious about reading this because I have children, and it's a hard, you know, even though I'm so lucky and like I'm,
yeah, what did you say, you can't breathe?
Yeah, like touching every piece of wood here, that my kids are healthy. But I would say that if you are worried about reading this, like, it does have a happy ending, so.
Right.
Everyone, not everyone is okay, but most people isn't okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. So so what's your pick? All right.
So
pick
mine is very much on the letter side.
Good.
A friend of mine, who I like to joke is my best life guru because she is really into living your best life, introduced me about 6 months ago to the Rock Clock, which, if you don't know it, is an alarm clock by the one and only The Rock, Dwayne Johnson. And so I downloaded this. I really like it. You can set a goal, and it can be something like, you know, be awesome every day. It can be something like, you know, run 10 miles this week, lose 20 pounds, whatever. So every day you get an inspirational message from The Rock. Sometimes it's a video, sometimes it's just text. So today, for example, it is a picture of him, and it says, use the hard times of the past to motivate you today. Okay, very inspirational. But then, the best part is that it comes with this alarm clock that you can set it to your own time, or you can set it to Rock time, which is the time of day that he wakes up. So you could, like, wake up at the same time as The Rock. But it gets even better. The alarms that come with this are the best alarms I've ever heard, and I'm going to play one for you right now. I'll play a couple because a lot of them are really great. So here is the first one. It's called Good Morning Sunshine. Let me make sure my volume is on my phone. But these are really great.
Good morning, sunshine.
That is The Rock singing.
Yeah, that's what The Rock just said.
All right, and then this one is The Roar. He's chanting, get up, get up. So if you have a teenager who likes to sleep in on the weekend, I really recommend turning this on for them. This is the kind of thing that my dad would have done when I was a teenager. So then in addition,
wake up to people chanting.
Yes, you're wake up. So in addition, I also steps. The Rock is awesome. He is like he had a marriage with this woman. They have like this gorgeous teenage daughter now. They got divorced ages ago. They're like in a business together. I mean, that's amazing.
Well, him and his ex-wife.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And so he also was in the film Moana. He was the voice of Maui, which I totally recommend. It was a great movie. And he sang in it. He was really funny. I follow him on Twitter. He's just, he like, we'll post videos of him on Twitter and Instagram of him meeting fans. A lot of, like, he's really nice to kids and that kind of thing. And he just seems like a really, really enormous, very nice person. Huh. And
he's in the wholesome part of his career.
He really is. He has a baby girl too. He has a girlfriend he's a baby girl with, and she's also adorable. And like a couple of things I didn't know. Like I didn't know that he's a really interesting ethnic background. Like he's part Maori, and he is part, apparently there is this group of folks called Black Nova Scotians that were slaves that made their way up north and were given refuge in Nova Scotia.
Whoa.
So he like kind of grew up in Hawaii, kind of grew up in California, kind of grew up in Canada. but like he's part Maori, so he kind of knew a lot of the Polynesian stuff in Moana. But so check Moana out. It's really good. I know I'm totally a Lin-Manuel Miranda fangirl. He wrote the songs for it. They're amazing. And
never a podcast goes by.
I know. I think it's my Lin-Manuel Miranda moment. And then, The Rock. Follow him on Twitter. Follow him on Instagram. Be inspired. He is a super... What's the word I'm looking for? He's a super positive guy. And he has even been posting recently about his own struggles with depression and everything. And it's great. So
didn't know that
check
about
out
the Rock.
I know he is real. Like you think he's just some, you know, some big dummy wrestler guy, but he's so much more. Thanks for listening to the Metro West Daily News podcast. This podcast was produced by Megan Kelly and Bill Shaner and was edited by Bill Shaner. Music was provided by the band Born Without Bones. Be sure to find us online at MetroWestDailyNews/podcast, and we're also on Twitter @MetroWestDaily and on Instagram also @MetroWestDaily. Thanks.